Hey, folks. As many of you know, Doing Justice is my new narrative podcast based on my best-selling book of the same name. It explores cases from the unique perspective of prosecutors grappling with urgent, legal, ethical, and moral questions. You can subscribe now for free by searching Doing Justice wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm pleased to offer this exclusive bonus just for Cafe Insiders with me in conversation with journalist Bianca Golodryga. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the creation of the podcast and the stories of those individuals seeking or caught in the crosshairs of justice. Hope you enjoy it.
Well, Preet, who would have thought that there was corruption in New York State?
Who would have thought?
I mean, the shocker of all shockers.
Turns out there was a lot.
There was a lot. And I love how you summed it up by focusing on three men who epitomize corruption and how it worked specifically in Albany, yet they obviously all have three individual stories and motives. And while they all might be categorized as doing bad things or even bad guys, they're all at different levels, I guess.
Yeah. You know what's interesting, putting this into context and thinking about why we chose this episode to do? Because we did a lot of corruption cases simultaneously with the Nelson Castro and Eric Stevenson case. And we had, you know, more significant and more renowned cases, including against the Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver, and the Senate Majority Leader, Dean Skelos. But there was something about this case and the particular ethical question presented of allowing a guy who we knew was guilty of a crime get reelected. So, you know, not the most massive corruption in the scheme of things, you know, pretty significant. But I thought this was an interesting story to tell, with where you have multiple characters like you described with different motivations, what it means to flip a guy who's in office, doesn't happen too often, what it would mean for deterrence in Albany. You know, I was excited for people to find out at the conclusion of the case that there was a member of the assembly who might have wired up. So they would be, you know, concerned and careful in how they went about their business.
How was this case received in Albany?
All the cases we brought during this time period were received poorly in Albany, which to me, you know, put a big shadow over a lot of the people in Albany. I remember being attacked personally by a lot of folks, and I thought that was odd because you would think that the good and decent and honorable people, and there were some of them to be sure, but a lot of people didn't feel that way. And instead of being angry and upset at their colleagues in the state Senate and in the state assembly, who had brought disrepute upon the body in a very serious way, they were angry about law enforcement. And I thought that spoke volumes about the culture in Albany.
The culture, the egos, right?
Yeah, the egos and just the brazenness and just the entitlement.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're just criminal prosecutors. People would say, well, how do you solve the problems? And prosecution does something, right? It deters. But, you know, people have to change the culture of their own institutions, whether it's a news organization or a school or a hedge fund. Prosecution can only do so much. And I remember being very frustrated with how they took it.
And in the conclusion, I mean, we can sort of work backwards and go and talk about these specific men. But in conclusion, you know, Governor Cuomo, he did launch an independent commission to investigate corruption in the legislature, but he shut it down prematurely. What was your reaction to that?
My reaction was bad. To put it in context, I think we say some of this in the episode, but there's not enough time to talk about all of it. The Castro and Stevenson case was brought down in the first week of April, and it wasn't the only case we brought in the first week of April back in that year. We had another very consequential public corruption case, and the combination of a bunch of indictments on a Tuesday and a bunch of indictments on the Thursday caused finally Governor Cuomo and others to think that they had to do something. So he set up, you know, an independent commission known as the Moreland Commission. Was in place for only about 9 months. And then for reasons that are not completely clear, no charges ever arose from it, but he disbanded it. And yeah, my reaction was angry. And sort of, I spoke my mind about it in the New York Times and on Brian Lehrer's radio show. And, you know, it was quite the spat. So what we did was we ended up sending vehicles to the Moreland Commission and we seized control and possession of all those documents and continued to work with them to bring our other cases.
And one of those cases happened to be Sheldon Silver. You know, I asked you what your reaction was to Cuomo prematurely shutting down this commission prior to the inauguration of a new president. In his final days in office, there had been rumors and reports circulating that in, you know, his final days, President Trump was considering pardoning Sheldon Silver.
What was my reaction?
Seems to have been, you know, all of the reports I'd read was that some of the reason why he was considering was because it was personal in that you were involved. What was your reaction to that?
I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, former President Trump, boy, it's nice to say former, you know, made some statements behind the scenes about one of the reasons he pardoned Blagojevich was because, you know, there's some connection to people he doesn't like. And the thought of pardoning people who had been prosecuted by Jim Comey, who he doesn't like. So I don't know if that's true, but my reaction to the report by the great Maggie Haberman from the New York Times that there had been an agreement to pardon Sheldon Silver, I didn't react very well to that. There seemed to be no reason for it. You had a corrupt Democratic politician, you know, much more serious criminal than Nelson Castro or Eric Stevenson, who lined his pockets with $4 million, convicted by a jury twice, that's a long story, had barely served any prison sentence because of all the appeals that he'd undertaken. And so I don't know what the reason was, but I will say what's also interesting is that the next day, when the full list of pardons came out, Sheldon Silver wasn't on it. And the reporting also from Maggie Haberman, again from the New York Times, was that he saw a lot of blowback from Republicans in New York and from you know, one of his favorite newspapers, the editorial page of the New York Post. So, you know, it's not usual that Donald Trump cares about any of that, but he seemed to in this case, and nevertheless, pardoned Steve Bannon, who hadn't even been convicted yet in the Southern District. So, you know, what kind of corruption the former president thought was worthy of pardoning or not pardoning is beyond my ability to comprehend.
I'm going to take a wild guess here and just say that I don't think that the president spent hours reading through these cases and court filings.
You don't think?
I don't think. I just, you know, given the 4 years that we've just experienced, I think I am probably correct in making that assertion. So I thought of you when I read his name, as did so many people, and I thought of you as probably having a good night when you saw that at least justice was served in Sheldon Silver's story and that he was not pardoned.
Yeah, no, I was getting ready to write about it. I was getting a little hot about it. But luckily, at least that one thing did not happen.
Going back to these three men, Nelson Castro and Zigfredo and Eric Stevenson, how common are characters like these in state legislatures across the country? I mean, I would imagine, look, it's an incredible story in and of itself, and they're all fascinating characters. But is this something that you see regularly, or was this sort of an outlier?
No, well, based on the other cases we brought in New York, some of which we've mentioned, it was par for the course. I mean, it used to be the case. I think I say this in the episode. You had a greater chance of being indicted by a grand jury than losing re-election if you were a New York State senator. It's hard to gauge levels of corruption because part of it depends on how much people are looking. We charged and convicted many, many, many state senators and state assemblymen. And, you know, 10 years before, there was very little of that kind of prosecution. That I don't think you can conclude from that people were being honest. I just think it wasn't being aggressively pursued. So with respect to these other states, it's hard to know if it's a matter of, you know, the legislature being honest or just lack of aggressive prosecution. I spoke once to after we did some of these cases, I got asked to speak to and address the entire legislature of Kentucky, the state legislature, to give them my best thoughts about how to avoid corruption. And my sense of doing research and looking at the cases there, they had actually done a better job, Kentucky, and New York could have learned something.
How so?
Well, they had passed laws about when you could fundraise, how you could fundraise, conflicts of interest. I think they had a rule about outside. I mean, part of the problem with all of this is when you go to the root cause is, you know, temptations get created, A, if you don't pay people in the state legislature enough, right? So there's various ways to go about it. If you don't pay them a lot of money, you're going to get a certain quality type of person. And if you pay them not a lot of money, but you also allow them to supplement their income with outside employment, that creates a problem. And that's how some of these people, you know, thought they could launder bribes and kickbacks like Sheldon Silver and others because they're allowed to be lawyers on the side.
Or buy themselves new Jaguars. like Eric Stevenson.
By themselves, new Jaguars. No, exactly. And again, this is outside of the realm and the scope of a prosecutor's function. But one thing is you have to manage the way people are allowed to raise money, how they're allowed to earn money. I mean, imagine if I was a U.S. attorney who also swore an oath to uphold the Constitution and I serve the public and I could supplement my income by, you know, having a consulting business on the side. How easy would it be for me to take bribes from criminal defendants and show the income? You know, while I'm a U.S. attorney, if anybody wants to take a look at my bank account, an investigator, and they saw all of a sudden hundreds of thousands of dollars coming in, there's clearly a problem because I was not allowed to make outside income because I was not allowed to split my loyalty between some private employer and between the government and my service to the public. These state representatives were allowed to do that. And that doesn't, you should be able to avoid temptation that way, but it's not a great structural setup to avoid, you know, bribery, kickbacks, and other types of crimes.
And we've already, you know, we figured out Eric Stevenson is not a good guy, not an upstanding citizen, you know, question his values, his morals. But why is it important to expose him, a politician like him? Obviously, he's not alone, but somebody that could be bought, right, could change laws and rewrite laws in order to line his coffers and work with the middleman. Why is it, from a larger standpoint, important to stop these actions?
The way I look at it is public corruption is different in kind from every other kind of crime. Other kinds of crimes, whether it's, you know, robbery or arson or a certain kind of fraud, there are victims and they're, you know, often identifiable. But if you weren't one of the victims, maybe you don't care so much about it. The problem is if you have a corrupt politician, everyone in that person's jurisdiction, the entirety of that person's constituency is victimized by it. They're victimized by it because it means that they have a representative who is not following their oath, meaning they don't have the best interests of you, the constituents, in mind. And it means that all sorts of good things that they could be embarking upon, they're not, because they're looking for the buck. It also, I think, is important because it should have a deterrent effect on other folks. I mean, Eric Stevenson's crime was significant and serious. It wasn't the crime of the century, but I think it's important to show that no one is above the law. We've had a lot of conversations about this over the last 4 years, right? And that goes for people who are elected to office. And the other way that people are victimized is it strips people's confidence in their government and it makes people cynical and makes them not want to vote. I mean, when we started bringing all these public corruption cases, the most mail I ever got, I didn't get a ton of mail, but the most mail I ever got in 7.5 years of being the U.S. attorney was in relation to these public corruption cases, especially Silver and Skelos and the others. And people said things in their letters and their notes like, I never thought anything could ever be done about corruption. I thought it was not useful to pay attention and to think about local politics because they're all corrupt and no one was ever going to do anything about it. And when we started bringing these cases, I think it got people to start to think, you know, maybe I can care and you can clean it up. And government can do good. I mean, these politicians, you know, people have not heard of their state legislatures, but they have a lot of power. They do a lot of stuff. They affect your schools. They affect your taxes. And, you know, they benefit a little bit by being under the radar. And by prosecuting the worst of them, I think you put them on the radar. And it, to some extent, if it's appropriate to say, you put them in the crosshairs of law enforcement. And it hopefully makes everyone else act more cleanly, too.
But yet, Preet, you know, you have this uneasy feeling about these particular, you know, Eric Stevenson, I would say in particular, because he came away popular, wanted to run again, had a lot of support, did not come across as remorseful at all. And, you know, there seems to be something unjust and unsettling when you do everything you can to the extent that the law allows. And, you know, the end result is not somebody who is an example for society and for his peers and for his constituents of what not to do. Maybe that's the case for some, but he certainly didn't feel that way. And he had enough of his supporters who still sided with him.
You know, you make a good point. And the way I think about that, and I'm not just a former prosecutor and I wasn't just the U.S. attorney, I'm a person and I'm also a citizen of the state. And so I care about those things. But it is also the case that, you know, you can't solve any deep-seated social problem just by prosecuting them. Case in point, you can't necessarily make people not want to vote for somebody merely by prosecuting them. If they are talented enough, shifty enough, and you have a public who is forgiving enough, people can rise again. And the most that the prosecutors can do is make their case appropriately, recommend whatever the appropriate sentence is, and then, you know, other people are free to screw it up if they want. That's not a very satisfactory answer. It's not a very uplifting answer, but it's kind of the way it is.
And in the short term, it feels that's how things played out for President Trump as well. And, you know, I'm not comparing Nelson Castro to Michael Cohen, but I think we're still scarred by this whole administration. So I could see some similarities in somebody who did something wrong, then try to repent for it and do right and cooperate, and nevertheless still serve time behind bars. And, you know, the primary suspect, the real bad guy here, someone like Eric Stevenson, seems to have had a better outcome than someone like Nelson Castro. Does that make you think twice about the role of informants and what kind of life they end up having down the road?
Not really, because you can't predict what's going to happen, and people have free will and they are told all the risks. And generally speaking, whether it's a public corruption case or not, cooperating, flipping helps your situation tremendously. And I think ultimately helped Nelson Castro's situation. You know, what you said made me think about something that I think is very important about culture. And it's not just the culture of the legislature, the institution that you're investigating. It's the culture of mind of the public. And one of the reasons Donald Trump or Eric Stevenson or someone else can live again, in part, is because there's a public culture of mind, I think, where there's some people who say, you know what? They're all corrupt. They all lie. They all cheat. They all steal. The difference is this guy got caught, and they forgive it, not because they're forgiving criminality, but they're judging them all by the same low standard. They're all bums. This is our bum. And he was caught, but he did these other good things. Let's send him back. And so one of the reasons, going back to your earlier question, why it's important to try to clean up, you know, political institutions and expose corruption, and if possible, in the public, shine a light on the people who actually have integrity, is so that you erode that very cynical culture of mind that the public has. And so instead of asking the question, you know, do they all take bribes, they should hear examples of people who are actually upset to have even been approached. What's so interesting about this case, whether you think it was a good case or righteous to allow Nelson Castro to be reelected or not, you know, what happened when bribes were offered? It's not just that they were accepted ultimately. It's that there was no anger on the part of the person receiving the bribe. I once had Harry Reid, former Senate Majority Leader, on the Stay Tuned podcast. And you don't hear a lot about this kind of story anymore. He was head of the Gaming Commission in Nevada, and people tried to bribe him. And he alerted the FBI, and the FBI came and wired up his office and were waiting outside for the bribe to be paid, and it would be a sting. And before the FBI could come through the door, guy offers Harry Reid the bribe as a gaming commissioner. And Harry Reid comes out from behind his desk and punches the guy in the face. And I said, Senator Reid, why'd you punch the guy in the face? He said, I was so insulted that he thought I could be bribed, that I assaulted the guy just as the FBI was coming in the door. And there's a complete absence of that outrage and indignation in this episode, because these guys didn't feel that way. And I think that's part of the problem here.
And of course, you can't talk about corruption in New York. And I can say this because I actually have cousins named Igor, and they are clean and they are law-abiding.
I'm
and
sure
very,
they are.
Very upstanding citizens. But you can't make this up. The two Igors who have an adult daycare plan facility. I mean, this isn't something that, you know, is earth-shattering in terms of some of the kickbacks that Sheldon Silver was charged with, right, and convicted of. But an adult daycare center actually made its way up to state law because of bribery.
What they wanted was they bribed a state assemblyman who was going to write legislation for them to eliminate competition. And I think I said at the press conference, you know, in one fell swoop, undermine principles of both democracy and capitalism at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, is that the biggest thing in the world? Maybe not. But what it symbolizes and what it violates is incredibly important. And that is that legislation shouldn't be able to be bought. You know, somebody said, I remember, forget it, at the press conference when I'm announcing this case, a reporter said, how many other bills do you think have been introduced that are the product of bribery? And I paused and I said, 26. And the reporter looked at me funny and I said, no, I'm joking. I have no idea. How do I know? And that's part of the tragedy here. Once you know that one bill can be bought with a bribe, then it makes you question everything else. And then you go back into that cycle of the culture of cynicism in the minds of the public. Oh, this is what it's like. And then when legitimate bills get passed, everyone has to wonder, oh, well, who paid who for that? Look, it's the same thing with these pardons. With all the swirling around prior to the inauguration of people willing to pay a lot of money, you know, there's a cloud over the pardons because people have a basis to believe that some or many of them have been bestowed based on corruption. It's a terrible, you know, way for people to be served by their government when they have so much, you know, pessimism about whether they're living up to their oaths or not.
How would you say things in Albany are today in terms of how things are functioning and the level of corruption? I know that there were some lawmakers, there were laws put in place that if a lawmaker had been convicted of corruption, they couldn't collect their pension. I mean, there were certain provisions enacted following these convictions.
So I don't have a precise metric, but in talking to reporters and in talking to some members of the legislature and in, you know, seeing the lack of prosecutions, I think there's still been a focus on it. I think the Public Corruption Unit in SDNY is still focused on all these things. I think there's been a significant change for the better. I think, among other things, the two long-serving leaders of the chambers, the Assembly and the Senate, who are deeply corrupt, both left. I think that makes an impression on other people. Not on everyone, but it makes an impression on some. And I think they at the top were responsible for a lot of the bad culture. And then you had a lot of other folks who were arrested as well. I think you also have some newer people who were inspired to go into politics because they wanted to clean up Albany. And so anecdotally, my understanding is it's better. But you can't rest, because where there is, at the intersection of power and money and authority, there's always opportunities for graft. And that will always be true.
Of course. But, you know, thanks in part to you and your colleagues, at least New Yorkers will have a few other options, more than one at least, of adult daycare facilities in their future.